When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. It's me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters close to the stars. This is episode 257 of the Colombia Calling podcast. And our very special guest today is a repeat guest and, of course, an important figure in the journalism news scene here in Colombia, Adrian Alselma, director of Colombia Reports. And we're going to chat a little bit about, well, I don't know if it's going to be a particularly upbeat episode, but we need to chat about, you know, what's coming up in Colombia for 2019. What do we expect to be the news stories in 2019 for Colombia? So, Adrian, over there in Medellin, welcome once again on Colombia Calling.
Thank you.
You're most welcome. We may as well. Now, it's a tricky one, isn't it? I mean, we've got a weak president who has got no control of his Congress. It seems like he's being, you know, there's a puppet master, one or more. We've got an attorney general who has all sorts of links. We have social and community leaders being assassinated. 2019 is not looking too rosy.
No, and we got elections coming up in October, which is likely going to increase the pressure.
So let's focus to start then. Let's you know, one by one at the moment. And so for me at the moment, the most pressing issue is obviously this issue of corruption and everything surrounding Odebrecht and the Attorney General and how far these tentacles go. What do you feel about this issue?
It's devastating the state system. If you look at how far the tentacles of Odebrecht go, you're talking about three consecutive presidents, the current chief prosecutor, the country's richest men, and a whole bunch of very politically powerful people who may have accepted bribes or have facilitated corruption. And according to the opposition, not just in the Odebrecht scandal that's being investigated now, but also other projects leading back all the way to the 2009 scandal that cost the head of Bogota Mayor Samuel Moreno.
Oh, God, yeah. And of course, talking about that, is it some of the Nules are getting out of jail right now as well? They seem to have paid their terms.
Well, something very weird is going on.
Something behind the scenes, yeah.
Because people are being released from prison well before their due time.
So the feeling I'm getting at the moment, it kind of feels like, again, the bad old days when you had your elites or high-ranking politicians rubbing shoulders with the narcos and the cartels. But in this circumstance, it's sort of your elites and high-ranking politicians with where the money is. You know, it seems like we're returning, or if we ever left, but returning to the bad old days of a banana republic.
And at the same time, that elite carrying out quite a harsh political persecution against opposition forces.
Well, that's right.
If you take into consideration that Martinez last week, a day after opposition Senator Gustavo Petro tried to explain the magnitude of the corruption and how many people are involved, it took him less than 24 hours to accuse Petro of election fraud, which I perceive as a very dinky claim and a very clear example, and not even the first example of severe political prosecution of the opposition.
And of course, Gustavo Petro, former M19 guerrilla, former mayor of Bogota, very polemic figure in Colombia, of course, runner-up in the last election. But you get the feeling that the ultra-right wing need Petro more than the left wing need Petro, because it's easier for them to create the stigma and this feeling of absolute terror they can instill into the public. You know, like, he's left wing, we're going to be Venezuela. And you know, the Attorney General, Néstor Martínez, he knows this.
Yeah.
Yeah, it just seems to be, they seem to play it every single time, and it just seems like it's another smokescreen.
Well, there seems to be a smokescreen being fabricated every time that Petro, who is an excellent senator, like he may have been a mediocre at best mayor of Bogota, but as senator, the guy is very strong. I believe it goes beyond that. Like you have the stuff that's happening inside Bogota and the political persecution against Petro, but at the same time you have extreme violence that is targeting people who are socially active or are at the first steps of being politically active. That are being assassinated in the countryside at a rate that is just terrifying.
Well, by the 9th of January this year, there were already 7 murders.
Correct.
Crazy. I mean, this is crazy. This is a speed unlike any of that we've seen, even in Colombia's bloodiest periods.
Well, I mean, Colombia's bloodiest period obviously were carried out took place in the middle of a war, where there was literally like in the year 2000 there was like one massacre a day, so putting it in perspective to me seems important, but still like. We are dealing with what appears to be an extermination of a certain layer in the political or in the socio-political system that is crucial for a healthy social fabric, like people who are either trying to get their land back that was stolen in the war, people who have gained traction locally and could be running in local elections later this year are getting assassinated. Farmers who are trying to implement a peace process through the voluntary crop substitution program. This is like you're cutting down a tree, if you know what I mean. You're disconnecting. What's happening in effect is disconnecting citizens or communities with the political system. But a lot of the majority of social leaders that are being murdered are members of communal action boards, they are called. And they are sort of like village councils that are often if not always, the bridge between a rural community or a neighborhood in a city and the political players. And the fact that these people are being targeted is extremely worrisome, because they disconnect entire communities from the political system.
Which is, of course, what these people want. They want them, this disconnection. So, but let's throw the idea out there, because I know that I'll get a couple of people listening to this, or a couple or more listening to this, and they'll say, well, you know, and I've had some trolls recently as well. These social and community leaders aren't social or community leaders that we know. That's the first thing that my trolls will say, is that they are guerrilla sympathizers or NGO facilitators or guerrillas themselves. Well, I mean, what do we say to that? How does one respond?
Well, I believe it's a person's human right to be sympathetic to certain political ideals. So even if a social leader is associated with the FARC is a political party now. And these people, like, it's okay if you don't like communists, but that doesn't give you the right to kill them. Mm. However, this is not what's going on. Like, what these people are victim representatives, often like people that have fallen victim of the FARC. These are small farmers. These are people that have nothing to do with the armed conflict, and instead are literally giving their life to implement the country's peace process. So stigmatizing them as like sort of like unwanted persons or something, to me is extremely I find it repulsive.
It's very cynical, isn't it?
Well, it's not cynical. It's false. People have been making associations or have been saying that Guacho, the FARC dissident leader who was killed by the security forces in December. That he was a social leader. Like, that type of stigmatization is exactly what gets these people killed. Mm. And I find this of a heartlessness that I can just not comprehend.
I don't know. So one question I have. I mean, you know, I was pitching something to an editor who shall remain unnamed because the piece never came through. But this execution, summary executions of social and community leaders, it's, you know, in three figures. It's been going on for some time now. It's going to continue unabated, as you suggest as well, with the October local elections. But so we know who the sicarios are. I mean, we know who the killers are. But we know who's pulling the trigger, but who are the people sending out the orders?
Well, I believe this is a wide range of people, but I think you can divide them in three groups. One is the drug traffickers that simply oppose the crop substitution program because they need coca to make cocaine. Then there's a second group that is the far right, and that consists of business people and elite politicians that simply are still in the war mode, where they believe that deadly violence is justified to make sure that they can get their economical plans done, or their political opponents eliminated. And then there's a third group, and that's the landowners that simply refuse to return land to people who were displaced during the conflict. And basically by killing the people they stole the land from, they prevent land restitution.
Which, of course, is one of the base causes of all of the problems. Obviously, there's all sorts of different evolutions over the years, but land...
Yeah,
but
land. Here's the thing with Colombia's armed conflict. Like, there's always been a lot of talking about the drug trafficking element, but the big issue has been land. Like, during the conflict, an area the size of Belgium was dispossessed. And there are like 50,000 people who are reclaiming land that was dispossessed from them, and that is now owned by apparently very violent landowners, miners, and God knows who else. And I believe that this is a lot of people.
So, I mean, obviously, as we're winding down this first segment of the show, we don't see it getting better at all. But, as we think about it, how is this all going to affect then the peace agreement with the FARC? I mean, it seems to be that many of the different items on the agenda are being starved of the cash flow needed and the political will to carry them through.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's like the, I don't even know if we can still speak of a peace process. Like the FARC may have gone, But the conflict that the FARC was part of is more alive than ever. Basically, we are back in the late 1980s when drug trafficking began playing a role in the armed conflict, and the FARC was trying to being politically incorporated. But as a consequence, that thousands of people were assassinated and a whole political party was eliminated. It feels like we are back at that level, which is terrifying. Because what followed in the 1980s was an escalation of conflict that hadn't taken place in any of the years before. And the risk is that this is going to happen again, so that there's going to be a massive rearmament and possibly a reactivation of armed conflict.
Very worrying indeed. This is Columbia Calling, and I'm Richard McCall, talking to the director of Columbia Reports, Adrian Alselma, who's in Medellin at the moment. Columbia Reports, if you don't know it, well, you should, columbiareports.com, the largest English news website out of Colombia, telling stories that I think surpass, obviously, the press. And the national press, of course, do not want to cover them. Gets Adrian in trouble at times, but these things need to be exposed and need to be told. So we'll just take a short break and come back in the second segment of this episode 257, and we'll remain talking to the enfant terrible of Colombian news, the Dutchman, Adrian Alselma. So don't go away. We'll be right back. Thank you for listening. And we're back. This is Columbia Calling. I'm Richard McCall here in Bogota, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. It's episode 257 of the Columbia Calling podcast. As you know, we're talking to Adrian Alselma, who's in Medellin, the director of Columbia Reports, the largest English news website out of Colombia. Now, it's been a gloomy episode so far. I mean, it's been a gloomy episode, but it's important to talk about these things that... You know, we've largely been talking around the corruption and this systematic elimination of social and community leaders. But I don't think we can just sort of draw the conversation a little bit to show and to tell our listeners just how bizarre the situation is. And I think bizarre might be the right word, not trying to undermine the seriousness of what's going on. But if we think about, and Adrian, you'll correct me if I get anything wrong here, the Minister of Hacienda, Alberto Carrasquilla, he is completely implicated in the Odebrecht scandal when he was at Configura Capital, so like you know, another company. That's 2009.
Which was in the Panama Papers.
It's in the Panama Papers. There's contracts with Odebrecht. There's contracts with Odebrecht through Invias, which is like the national infrastructure and road system, let's say, entity here. PricewaterhouseCoopers, you know, obviously the big company, you know, smelt a rat and have been investigating. They, in turn, have informed the U.S. Treasury, who are doing their own investigation. Then we've got Felipe Arias, the Uribito, who's in, you know, seeking asylum in the U.S. He's been there for however many years. Equally guilty in various things, but under investigation as well by the U.S., it seems that the Colombian justice system isn't pursuing these people. And if the U.S. justice system pursues these people and finds them guilty by following the receipts and following the money, what kind of image is Colombia going to have on the world stage?
I don't think there's going to be much of an image left apart from one of the most blatant kleptocracies in the world. The levels that corruption has, like corruption has reached levels that include the Supreme Court. Like the Supreme Court has been compromised. The chief prosecutor is compromised. Three consecutive presidents are compromised. Several ministers are compromised. The Congress, which is widely seen as the most corrupt institution of the country, we haven't even talked about. It seems that corruption has simply eroded Colombia's state system to the point that it's come to a complete halt. Like the president has barely been able to pass laws through Congress. There doesn't seem to be any central control either over policy or over the security situation in the country, and it's just political anarchy.
All in a nice suit, let's say. People are well dressed and you've got this anarchy going on. It's very concerning. I find, you know, and I've only been here for 12 years, but I've been coming since 1998 prior to that. But you just feel that this is a really unstable time in Colombia. When I first came in 1998, you knew the violence was everywhere. When I traveled the Pacific coast in a chalupa and I was reporting various things, you could feel the aggression, but it was there and it was a different feeling. Now it just feels like we're on incredibly unstable ground. That's right. Just anything could almost happen.
On thin ice.
Thin ice is the perfect description. What do we think is going to pan out over the rest of 2019?
Well, what wasn't the case in the late 1990s and is the case now is that the United Nations is in the country and monitoring the peace process. And this peace process includes a lot of the developments, including the killing of social leaders. So the international monitoring of what is happening in Colombia is much more elevated than before. Last year, the United States decided to really begin investigating corruption cases in Colombia, and within no time, politicians started, well, in this case, like the anti-corruption chief of the corruption was extradited to the United States.
Handpicked, of course, by Nestor Humberto Martinez.
Handpicked. According to media reports, like the United States Justice Department is now investigating as many as 26 top officials, like in both the legislative branch, the judicial branch, and the executive branch. So there's going to be a lot of legal pressure coming from the United States. There is a lot of diplomatic pressure coming from the United Nations and the European Union. So what that's concerned, there is some protection from Colombia, like completely failing as a state again. However, it's going to be diplomatically very controversial if the U.S. is going to really move forward with criminal investigations against top officials in Colombia, and also the United Nations and the European Union all also have limited mandate to mess in what essentially are Colombian national, like, internal affairs.
That's right. I mean, and it could end up being a Guatemala situation where they try and kick them all out.
Yep.
Yeah. Let's put this into a more sort of general conversation. This is not, I mean, we've got Iván Duque as president, who, in the politest possible terms, he's kind of like the useful imbecile who has been plucked from absolute,
obscurity
and put into the presidential palace, put into this seat. He is completely unqualified. There's been no plan for his presidency. There's no plan, let's say, that's clear to the public or clear internationally.
Well, the plan was to retake power over Colombia's state system, and this seems to have been the end game of Uribe and the Democratic Center, where they just wanted to retake control over the country's politics. And however, there are no clear formulated policies. So and this is why the elections were so weird, because they were never about what policies are we going to implement to move Colombia forward, and the ones that were implemented, populist policies rallying against the peace process, are now biting Duque in the ass, and there's nothing happening in Bogota.
No, this is true. I mean, it's absolute wasteland at the moment, and I mean this is a country that on various terms claims to have never had suffered a real recession and has been the most in inverted commas stable democracy in the Americas.
Well, that's a bit of a lie.
I know, it's just nice packaging. It's kind of like Costa Rica not having an army but having, you know, three different types of police force all armed with semi-automatic weapons. But what do we see the future in terms of investment and international business here in Colombia? I mean, you're better placed than I to talk about this.
Well, I see this also on thin ice, because in the what happened in the, earlier on in the 1990s and in the 2000s is that, like, a lot of investors were attracted to Colombia, being promised gold mountains, and many of them are now in legal trouble because they hooked up with the human rights violators. So I think that many investors are very cautious about investing in Colombia. I don't particularly see this as a bad thing, because like investment in countries like Colombia has generally only been about like extracting resources rather than investing in the development of the economy. But I think Colombia is just going to become very uninteresting for foreign investors. And this is going to affect the potential economic growth of the country. Not even the economic growth, but the development of the Colombian economy.
The diversification of it, which is so urgently needed.
Well, yeah, and job creation and all kinds of like basic elements that you need to say that you have a developed economy.
And bringing this conversation round and closer to home, are we seeing a greater censorship of the press? Are we seeing the press being stifled in trying to tell these stories? I mean, I don't know. I mean, what's...
The press has always been hardly independent in Colombia. And are still, like, if you look at the main news media in Colombia, they are largely paid by the government and financially dependent on the government, and have traditionally always done reporting as if it were delivering propaganda. And over the past decade, a lot of independent news outlets have sprung up in both Spanish and in English. And we now have social media. So I believe that the press is performing better than ever before. And clearly this is making the authorities very nervous. But it's also like an unstoppable trend. So there is resistance against like this enforced press corps, but I think this is an unbeatable battle.
But we managed to turn the conversation to something slightly positive there.
Well, there are other positive things, like with there may be a lot of violence against and political persecution against the opposition, but that's only because the opposition is stronger than ever. So we are looking at a political climate that is far more politically diverse than it was a decade ago. And even more so than 20 years ago, and there are people acting against it, but also there's only so much evil you can do there. You saw how Duque got elected, and within no time his approval rating plummeted. Well, this is obviously going to affect the local elections in October, and that means that it's likely that the old corrupt political parties are going to perform are going to have a lot more headwind than they ever had. So what that's concerned, you can see a sort of an emancipation of Colombia's democracy also in like the mobilizations of students that you've seen, the mobilization against Néstor Humberto Martínez on Friday. There are developments going on in Colombian democracy that are positive developments. It's just that they are violently countered.
So do we think that these positive developments, you know, socially led, let's say, marches, socially convened marches and so on, and the new generation of Colombians coming through, and perhaps a generation of just exhausted Colombians with the situation. I think it's in the Spanish phrase, isn't it? The final drop of water that will spill over the edge of the cup. People are just fed up.
No, this is a gradual process. There is a big difference between Colombians that were educated by the Catholic Church in the 1980s, and people who were educated by the public education system. So you see a big generational gap of Colombians below and Colombians above 40 years old. And at one point, there's going to be a point where the people who did not grow up with the violence of Pablo Escobar, for example, or were educated by the Catholic Church, that they become a minority politically. And this is a trend that we are now slowly starting to see happening. And this is not going to this didn't result in an opposition victory in 2018, and it may not result in a sort of a political renewal in 2022. But this is like where we are going. Like the old Colombia is slowly dying out, and there's a whole new generation of Colombians who are educated differently, who have better access to information, and this generational conflict is what ultimately is going to decide where Colombia is going to go.
So it won't happen in 2019 nor in 2022, but we're looking further ahead. Proper generational shift in the reality of Colombia. I'll be very old by then, but we'll both be able to sit back and say, yeah, we told you so.
In 10 or 20 years, yeah.
But these things do take time. You're not going to have your Rose Revolution or what have you here. It's a different situation. Or Carnation Revolution or whatever, but if it is going to change, or if these people are going to be weeded out, these really, really rotten apples in this basket of rotten apples, it will take time because they're so deeply embedded.
But keep in mind that this country has been at war for 50 years and it's like, And this has left its scars. Like, we are talking about a country with a social fabric that's been severely damaged, and particularly in the older generations, and the younger generations are far more reasonable in a sense, and more worldly, and. If I may take my own country, the Netherlands, as an example, like, we were occupied by the Germans in the Second World War, and it took my country until like the mid 1980s to really get over it, to be like, okay, that's behind us, but that's 40 years. So like, if we are looking at a political shift in Colombia that's going to take 40 years, I believe that would be the natural course of change in this country. And obviously those who want peace and those who want a functioning democracy, like obviously we want a yesterday, but it's just not going to happen. And it was never going to happen. Realistically, this shift in society and in politics is going to take 40 years. Mm. was always going to take place, and it wouldn't be realistic, even though we want things to happen yesterday already. It's not realistic to expect such changes, such profound changes in the society, in a short period of time.
This is true. So I'm basically, it's going to take time, but I guess over this period of time, ups and downs and downs and ups and so on, we're going hopefully in the right direction?
Well, Colombia is going to modernize whether you want it or not. But that's going to take its due time, and it's disgracefully going to cost a lot of people's lives still.
It's a hard situation. It's a very difficult place, but it's a place that we call home. And, well, you've got to, I mean, your commitment to Colombia is to keep on putting out the Colombia Reports news website, your updates and so on. You're still looking for sponsors for Colombia Reports?
Yeah, always.
Okay, so people could just go out to Colombia Reports and there's some sort of donation page?
Yeah, people will find ways to support Colombia Reports throughout the website.
Very important that we continue to support independent journalism. As you said, as I've mentioned previously on the last episode, 256, a great episode with Michael Evans of the National Security Archive talking about Colombia's Truth Commission. As we said, I did mention that Colombia Reports and Colombia Calling will be partnering up for a news segment, a weekly news segment on the show with Adrian giving us a roundup. We're just a week behind on that, so hopefully next week we'll have Adrian on the show again giving us a roundup of what's going on in Colombia and what to expect, so that we keep people informed across all forms of media, not just the written page on the website, but also across these podcasts and so on. Let me take this moment to thank Adrian for his invaluable insights into what is going on in Colombia. Adrian, thank you so much for sharing with us. It may be gloomy, but it's a reality.
It's what we're going to have to live with.
It's what we're going to have to live with. It's what we have to understand to be able to, continue, and also to campaign and to be able to explain to the people out there what's going on. So that's us winding down today's show. It's been episode 257, as I said, with the director of Colombia Reports, Adrian L. Selma. Check out www.columbiareports.com for all your news needs. It's updated many times a day with news stories. I've been Richard McCall on the Columbia Calling podcast. I've got another interesting interviewee lined up for next week from the Universidad Pedagógica. So we'll be talking a little bit about what the students are looking for and what they want in terms of their marches and the paros that they have been conducting. So that's us signing off for today on episode 257. Thank you again for listening. This has been Columbia Calling. Bye-bye.